I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
So I was traveling with some friends recently, and while some of us were chatting one evening, one of them mentioned that they really liked the eponymous foods episodes. And they were like, it has been a minute since you did one. And I was like, okay, so here we are. Today, we're going to talk about sandwiches. So get ready to maybe get hungry, depending on what your feelings
depending
are.
Depending on what you like.
Any of these sandwiches, we're covering 3 sandwiches. The first is one I do not like. The second sandwich I love. And the third is my favorite sandwich of all time. It goes in the Holly Fry Sandwich Hall of Fame as the best one.
So we're starting with Sloppy Joes. Those are very popular in the United States for some reason, which probably reveals my feeling about Sloppy Joes.
We share an opinion on Sloppy Joes.
We can talk about it Friday. There are contested origin stories about this dish being invented here in the U.S., but one version places its origin outside the United States. This is a sandwich that, as its name suggests, is messy by nature. It typically features ground beef mixed with some kind of a tomato sauce, and then that mix is usually served on a hamburger bun. And there are lots of variations and way to improvise with this. Seasons can change up the flavor a lot, and some folks like to add things like onion or other minced vegetables, and 3 different places claim the Sloppy Joe as their own. There's Sioux City, Iowa, Key West, Florida, and Havana, Cuba. There's also a New Jersey honorable mention that we will talk about.
Yeah, that's not, incidentally, the order we're going to talk about them in, but it makes sense that the Sloppy Joe pops up in the United States in cooking in the 1930s, because this was a time when money was very tight. As a consequence, expensive ingredients like meat had to be stretched. So meatloaf had been around since the late 1800s, but the need to find ways to make protein sources go farther in the 1930s during the Depression led both restaurateurs and home cooks to get a little bit creative with ingredients mixed into meat to fill up hungry stomachs. This also harkens back to our episode on Auguste Escoffier, who similarly found ways to stretch available ingredients in the field when he was an army cook, and then when he was a chef during World War I and had to figure out how to run his luxury kitchen at the Savoy Hotel in London without things like butter.
We're going to start with the non-US origin story for the Sloppy Joe, though, because it informs one of the others. This starts not with a man named Joe, but rather Jose. Jose Abiali Otero was born in Spain in the 1800s. He moved to Cuba in 1904 and started working as a bartender in Havana. He worked there for 3 years and then moved to New Orleans, Louisiana, once again found work at a bar. Right around 1913, he moved south again to Miami, Florida, worked in a variety of establishments until 1918, and then back to Cuba.
After working for a bar and cafe in Havana called the Greasy Spoon for a few months, Jose decided he would rather work for himself than someone else. So he bought a grocery store that also had a cafe and bar. That's a pretty standard setup. And according to Jose's accounts, when one of his friends from the U.S. came to visit him in his new establishment, that friend said, quote, "Why, Joe, this place is certainly sloppy. Look at the filthy water running from under the counter." And from then on, he was known as Sloppy Joe. He seemed to embrace the idea of being known for having a messy business, so much so that he renamed the place Sloppy Joe's. In case you, like me, are wondering where that gross water was coming from, it was melting ice. Jose served a variety of seafood items in his grocery. He had, you know, fresh seafood set out on ice, and as that seafood ice melted, it slushed to the floor and made kind of a mess. In 1932, the Havana Sloppy Joe's Bar released a cocktails manual so that people could make the drinks from their cocktail menu at home. And in that manual, there is a brief biography of Jose Abiali Otero, who is shown in a photograph portrait at the front of the book with the nickname Sloppy Joe written under it. In the years of operation of Sloppy Joe's, Jose added a lot of touches to the place, including famously a 60-foot long bar.
Early in the Sloppy Joe establishment's history, there was a sandwich called a Sloppy Joe on the menu. And this was apparently a carry-around version of either ropa vieja or picadillo. Ropa vieja is made with shredded meat, tomato sauce, and various spices. Usually this is something you would eat with a fork, but Jose put it on bread. Picadillo is a similar dish made with ground beef, although it often has a lot of other ingredients. But if you put it on bread or a bun, does kind of sound like the Sloppy Joe sandwich.
And a lot of people from the U.S. started visiting Havana during Prohibition so that they could get a drink and enjoy the climate. And there were often celebrities lined up along that 60-foot bar. One famous figure who loved Sloppy Joe's bar and sandwich was Ernest Hemingway, so much so that he figured into the Key West version of the sandwich origin story. When Hemingway was in Key West, he lived there for, I think, a dozen years, he convinced another bar, the Silver Slipper, to rename itself Sloppy Joe's and put the sandwich on the menu. The Silver Slipper was owned by a man named Joe Russell, so the name Sloppy Joe kind of fit, again, for someone who is cool with being called sloppy, and he went for the idea. Joe Russell had also been to Havana with Hemingway on a number of trips, so it wasn't as though the author had to explain to Joe Russell who Sloppy Joe was or what a Sloppy Joe sandwich was. Russell seems to have pretty readily understood the appeal of both of these things, and that informed his decision to change his establishment's name. The Key West Sloppy Joes did not really claim to have invented the sandwich exactly. Still acknowledged the Cuban origins, but it did claim to have perfected it, inventing the American version. You can find out for yourself if you're ever in the area, because it is still open and the Sloppy Joe sandwich is still on the menu. So you can decide if you think that's perfect or not.
The third contender for the invention of the Sloppy Joe is a diner cook named Joe. This is the version that's associated with Sioux City, Iowa at Ye Olde Tavern Inn. This version has roots in another Midwest sandwich called the loose meat sandwich, and this is kind of like a burger in that it's made with ground beef or chopped meat, but it's not formed into a patty. And the cook named Joe, none of the Sioux City stories that Holly found included a last name, added tomato sauce and some spices, and in what sometimes gets called a tavern sandwich, Joe's creation became very popular with locals and its reputation spread.
Yeah, there are still places that will call a Sloppy Joe a tavern sandwich in the Midwest. So the location that we're going to offer as an honorable mention in this is Town Hall Deli in Maplewood, New Jersey. Apparently, in the 1930s, the mayor of Maplewood visited the Havana Sloppy Joe's and had the sandwich there, and then asked the owner of the Town Hall Deli to make it based on his description. That version, according to the Town Hall Deli website, featured, quote, coleslaw, ham, cow tongue, Swiss cheese, with lots of dressing, and was served on thin rye bread. That doesn't really sound very much like a sloppy joe or ropa vieja or picadillo. Town Hall Deli still exists. It has a variety of what they call sloppy joes on the menu. Although, to me, they all sounded more like sliced meat deli sandwiches than a sautéed ground meat cooked with a tomato sauce.
So, which of these stories is the real one? Maybe all of them? It's completely possible that different people had a similar idea around the same time. And there's also a secondary aspect of the Sloppy Joe story, and that's the idea of canned sauce and convenience foods. For a lot of home cooks in the post-World War II United States, products like Sloppy Joe sauce offered a shortcut to making tomato sauce from scratch, while also being malleable enough to doctor up into a more unique recipe. ConAgra Foods and Hunt's introduced the Manwich canned Sloppy Joe sauce in 1969. It's pretty easy to find write-ups of papers in the 1970s about how home cooks might use Sloppy Joe sauce. One from the Sacramento Bee that ran on December 16, 1970 reads, and our apologies here to Italian listeners, quote, "A passport is not needed to bring a profusion of Italian-inspired foods to your family table. A ready assistant is the new canned Sloppy Joe pizza sauce and beef, which lends itself easily to spooning on burger buns, topping spaghetti, or making a fast version of lasagna." The write-up goes on to share a recipe called Presto Lasagna, which is made with Sloppy Joe sauce and cottage cheese.
I have feelings. Schools have often included Sloppy Joes in cafeterias for the reason we mentioned earlier. It's cost-effective and it enables kitchens to serve more meals with less meat. I also read one note where someone had interviewed someone who was in charge of decisions such as, you know, what gets served in a school cafeteria. And she was like, "We also sneak vegetables in there and the kids don't know," which I think a lot of parents do as well. So perhaps the nostalgia of meals like this eaten as a kid has contributed to the survival of the Sloppy Joe over the decades.
The Havana Sloppy Joe's bar closed in the 1960s during the Castro regime. But in 2007, the Office of the Historian of Havana started a restoration of this fabled watering hole as part of a larger effort to restore Havana's old city. And after 6 years of work, it reopened in 2013. Now you can visit if you are in Cuba.
And I will talk about it on the behind the scenes because I have some quizzical dog question marks about reviews of it. We are coming up on National Sloppy Joe Day. If you're in the U.S., it's March 18th. So if you love them, go ahead and start making your plans. In the meantime, we're going to pause for a sponsor break. And when we're back, we will talk about a sandwich with a Kentucky origin story.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel for for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road trip or waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
If you have never had a sandwich called a hot brown, you are in for a rich, savory treat. It's an open-faced sandwich that's piled with roast turkey, bacon, pimentos or tomatoes, and Mornay sauce. Mornay sauce is our good friend bechamel, but with Parmesan Romano or Gruyere cheese added to it, or sometimes combinations of those cheeses. Occasionally, you might find other cheeses blended in, depending on who makes it. And once that sauce is spread across the top of the sandwich, the whole thing is broiled so the cheese gets bubbly, and then it's served, as the name indicates, hot. It is sometimes described as similar to Welsh rarebit, although the main similarity is really just that it's open-faced and broiled because there isn't a whole lot of overlap in ingredients beyond that. The cheeses are different.
The hot brown is named for the hotel where it was invented, which was named for the businessman who built it. That's James Graham Brown. Brown was born in 1881 in Madison, Indiana. He attended public school, then went to Hanover College and Purdue University. The Brown family moved to Kentucky in 1903, and as a young man, Brown went to work with his father in the lumber business. Their Eastern Kentucky operation grew over time, and at 37, Brown became the president of W.P. Brown and Sons Lumber Company.
Lumber was not the only business that Brown worked in, and over the years, he became one of Louisville, Kentucky's most prominent businessmen, particularly through the many construction projects named for him. In 1923, he built the Brown Hotel over the course of 10 months at a cost of $4 million on the corner of 4th and Broadway. He was inspired in this project by another Louisville hotel's success. That was the Seelbach. And Brown thought he could challenge the Seelbach's dominance as the luxury hotel of downtown. And he was right. The style of the Brown Hotel is Georgian Revival. It had 16 floors, and it opened on October 25th, 1923. British Prime Minister David Lloyd George was the first person to sign the guest register.
The Brown Hotel quickly became the center of Louisville's social and cultural scene, and J. Graham Brown expanded his downtown presence by also building a theater nearby. Eventually, he also erected a medical facility and an office building and a church. Since Brown lived in the hotel, he had essentially built everything that he could need within walking distance. At night in the hotel ballroom, a band would play dinner dances from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. for the late night crowd. And often there were more than 1,000 people there on any given evening. This also is where the Hot Brown was born.
So after the late night dancers had been entertained for a couple of hours, the band would take a break, typically right around midnight. And the hotel restaurants also stayed open late, so the party crowd would saunter into those to order a snack before the last set of the evening was played. This was a very popular cycle of entertainment, and it brought the hotel a lot of business in food sales for a while.
After a few years, the sameness of the way the dance evenings at the Brown Hotel played out left the city's nightlife a little bored, so business started to wane. There are a couple of versions of how the Hot Brown sandwich was invented in this moment of lag in 1926 and what led to its creation. One is that there was concern about guests having grown tired of the menu, so the need was seen for something new. Another is that the executive chef, Fred Schmidt, was just tired of sending out plates of club sandwiches and scrambled eggs and ham to his late-night diners and wanted to make something new. Seems possible or even likely that both of these were factors.
Yeah, if you read accounts by people that were involved in the whole thing, some of them put it one way and some put it the other, and I think probably both are the case. The choices of ingredients for the sandwich were informed, according to legend, by time of year. It was winter, which meant that the hotel had turkey on hand because of holiday celebrations. It's said that putting it on sandwiches was kind of a novel idea, as the poultry was normally reserved for more formal holiday meals.
Rudy Suck, who managed the Brown Hotel during the time the hot brown was invented, told the story as a somewhat collaborative effort, noting that he thought the initial plan sounded, quote, a little flat, before Chef Schmidt said that he would put it under the broiler to bubble the cheese in the sauce. The maitre d's initial reaction to a stack of turkey on bread with a white sauce was that it needed a little color. To add that splash of color, the bacon and pimentos were added, although over time, the hotel's version shifted away from pimentos to tomatoes. The dish quickly became popular. It's remained a staple of Louisville and the Brown Hotel, with a few gaps that we will talk about, for a century.
James Graham Brown died in 1969, and his legacy is a little bit of a mixed bag. He was documented as being very anti-union and pretty racist. He did not, for example, want Kentucky to desegregate, and he publicly stated that if a union were to form at his hotel, he would sell the whole thing. He also, though, gave generously to charity, and when he died with no next of kin after having lived for decades in a small suite at the hotel, he left his $100 million estate to the people of the city, having arranged for numerous charities and public works projects to be funded long-term from his fortune, with the wording of his will indicating that the money was to be used to promote the well-being of the citizens and bring recognition to both Louisville and the rest of the state. His foundation is still in operation. It uses funds to invest in a variety of organizations to promote economic prosperity, education, and quality of life.
After Brown's death, the hotel that had become a foundation of the downtown scene of the city faltered. It ultimately closed in 1972 and was sold to the Jefferson County Public School System, which used it as an office space for the Board of Education until it was purchased, refurbished, and reopened as a Hilton Hotel in 1984. Then it passed to the Camberley Hotel Company. Today it's managed by the 1859 Historic Hotels Group, and it's on the National Register of Historic Places.
The Brown Hotel today will happily serve you a hot brown almost anywhere on the premises. The hotel restaurants and bar have it on the menu. You can have one brought to you via room service. If you don't eat meat, there is a vegetarian version available. I think it uses mushrooms, as well as a smaller size version of the original for anybody who finds the rich dish too filling to eat a full size order. The Brown Hotel says that typically they sell about 1,000 hot browns each week, although during the Kentucky Derby, it is usually more like 300 each day and sometimes even higher. The hotel also shares its recipe for the original hot brown on its website, revealing that the Mornay sauce served there does not include Gruyere, or at least it seems that way. The actual Mornay sauce recipe used in the kitchen of the Brown remains a secret. The official recipe does also call for the crust to be cut off of the toast.
Incidentally, there are other sandwiches that are very similar to the hot brown, particularly a St. Louis dish called a prosperity sandwich. The prosperity is almost identical, but adds ham. This also popped up in the 1920s.
Yeah, it's believed that this is definitely a take on the hot brown. Nobody thinks that St. Louis invented it. And also, as a coda here, we mentioned two sauces in this discussion that also qualify as eponymous food. So we'll give you very brief explainers for these. First off, bechamel. It is named for Louis de Bechamel, Marquis de Nointel, who was the maître of the Duc d'Orléans in the 17th century. He's believed to have had a hand in its creation, or more specifically, altering an existing cream sauce recipe. But that is argued by aficionados of Italian cooking history because bechamel is the same thing as a Tuscan sauce that preceded it, known as salsicoia, which is glue sauce. The Italian origin story credits Catherine de' Medici with bringing the recipe to France.
The other sauce we mentioned was Mornay, which uses bechamel as a base. Mornay sauce has uncertainty regarding its naming attribution. It's usually noted as having been named after Philippe, the Duc de Mornay, but that has been argued because he died in the 1600s, which was long before Mornay sauce showed up in the early 19th century. So it's possible that this was named for someone else. There are a number of possible Mornays. No evidence that they specifically inspired the sauce.
Yeah, there are definitely people where someone goes, hey, this is a Mornay that was a fairly prominent person at the time this sauce pops up, but there's never really a clear indicator that they had any involvement in it. It is almost time for my favorite sandwich segment. But first, we are going to hear from some of the sponsors that keep Stuff You Missed in History Class going.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
All right, it's time for a contentious one and the most delicious one. The origin of this is either New York or Nebraska, and either way, the Reuben is made with corned beef, sauerkraut, Swiss cheese, and Thousand Island dressing on rye bread. It's usually pressed or grilled. It is a poem of sandwich perfection in my book. I love this sandwich so much. So the first contender that we're going to talk about as the origin is Reuben's Restaurant and Delicatessen in New York, which was opened by a man named Arnold Reuben. Arnold was of German-Jewish ancestry. He was born in Germany in 1885.
In the 1930s, the U.S. Works Progress Administration launched the Federal Writers Project, Folklore Project, Life Histories. And from 1936 to 1939, they collected stories from people about their lives. Arnold Rubin gave his story on December 18th, 1938. Arnold Manoff conducted the interview and also provided additional text that contextualizes who the interviewee is. Manoff's description of the restaurant reads as follows, quote, "The restaurant can be briefly described as an interior near Fifth Avenue designed to resemble the lounge room of the Radio City Music Hall. Soft light, subdued lighting, rich carpeting, and Mr. Rubin's stuffed fish mounted around the walls. A small bar near the check room and a delicatessen counter in the back. More detailed, this is the impression you get of Rubin's. You're walking up 58th Street toward Fifth Avenue. Suddenly, the wall of brick to your left is ended, and the periphery of your eye catches a huge pane of glass curtained in cream folds and shrubberied formally at the bottom. A red blazing neon sprawls over the window. Rubens. Typical. This is Rubens. Who is Ruben that his name should stand alone without a word of explanation, without even a first name, without a company or ink after it? Well, all right. Ruben, 25 feet long, 5 feet high on 58th Street, right next to the Savoy Plaza, the Sherry Netherland. Nearby Central Park, the Old Plaza, Fifth Avenue, nearby Park Avenue, a ritzy restaurant if you judge by what you can't see from the outside."
The form that Manoff filled out lists under Rubin's special skills and interests, and this charmed me to pieces. Quote, "Special skill at concocting sandwiches. Interested in fishing." The form also described Arnold as healthy and alive in the Broadway nervous tempo manner.
Arnold's statement to Manoff talks about how he got started as a peddler as a kid and eventually became the father of the sandwich. He described the origin of the sandwich, quote, "Well, I'll tell you about how I got the sandwich idea. I owned a delicatessen on Broadway, and one day a dame walks in, one of the theatrical dames, and she's down and out, I suppose, and she asked me for something to eat. Her name was Anna Silos. Well, I'm feeling sort of good, so I figure I'll clown around for the dame. That's how it all came about. I'm clowning for the dame. Well, what do? I take a holy bread that I used to keep and grab the knife and, you know, clowning like I cut it right through the bias. Then I take some roast beef. I don't remember exactly what, but anyway, I figure I'll put anything on. So I take some meat and cheese and I slap it on. I put some spice and stuff, and I make her up a sandwich. It was a foot high. Well, the dame just eats it, that's all. She must have been plenty hungry, and when she gets through, she says, 'Mr. Rubin, that's the best sandwich I ever tasted in my life.' Well, the idea comes to me in a flash. I'll call it the Anna Silos sandwich after the dame. Then one night, she brings some friends up, you know, stage people and a newspaper man, and this guy, he goes right behind the counter and makes himself up a sandwich. And then he tells me, 'Why don't I call the sandwich after celebrities, like what happened with Anna Silos? Why don't I call it the Anna Silos sandwich?' Well, boys, in a flash, I get the idea. Anna Silos. I'll call it a Reuben special." And that's how it started.
Bless Tracy for reading that long quote I included. For a 1985 book called Craig Claiborne's The New York Times Food Encyclopedia, Arnold Rubin's daughter, Patricia B. Taylor, gave the following quote describing the sandwich's origin. It has some subtle differences to her father's version. It's also a little shorter. She said, quote, "The year was 1914. Late one evening, a leading lady of actor Charlie Chaplin came into the restaurant and said, 'Rubin, make me a sandwich. Make it a combination. I'm so hungry, I could eat a brick.' He took a loaf of rye bread, cut two slices on the bias, and stacked one piece with sliced Virginia ham, roast turkey, and imported Swiss cheese, topped off with coleslaw and lots of Rubin's special Russian dressing, and the second slice of bread. He served it to the lady, who said, 'Gee, Rubin, this is the best sandwich I ever ate. You ought to call it the Annette Silos special,' to which he replied, 'Like hell I will. I'll call it a Rubin special.'"
Though Arnold Rubin was very confident that he invented the Rubin sandwich, there's another contender which also has a good story, and that is Bernard Schimmel. This version is championed by Schimmel's granddaughter, Elizabeth Wheel, who first shared her family's story of the sandwich in the New York Times Magazine. According to her, her great-grandfather was a hotelier who opened hotels along the railroad lines, starting in Chicago and running west. and her grandfather, Bernard, was also in the family business.
In the 1920s, Bernard often played poker with his friends at the family's Blackstone Hotel in Omaha, Nebraska. And one night, one of the players wanted a sandwich. That player was Ruben Kulikovsky, and he asked for a sandwich specifically with corned beef and sauerkraut. Though Schimmel dressed it up with Swiss cheese and dressing, which is arguably what makes a Reuben, sometimes Ruben Kulikovsky is given credit for creating it. And that has also been complicated over the years because Reuben's last name has sometimes been shortened to K, K-A-Y, in various retellings. Because the resulting sandwich, though, regardless, turned out so delicious, Schimmel put it on the menu at all of the family's hotels.
Now, this has led to impassioned debate. The Reuben is, to some, a quintessential New York sandwich, and Arnold Reuben's family story is that he invented it in 1914. There's no supporting evidence for that. On the other hand, there are print menus and newspaper mentions of the Schimmel origin, but the earliest one is from 1934 on a menu from the Blackstone. This is later than the New York version is said to have been created, but it's the oldest primary source specifically naming the sandwich. Still, even the Reuben family's earlier story describes a sandwich that has ham, turkey, and coleslaw on it, which is not exactly the Reuben sandwich as it's known today.
Either way, it's the Schimmel Hotel Group that won acclaim for the sandwich in 1956, because that year it was entered into the National Sandwich Idea Contest by a chef from one of the Schimmel hotels, and it won. And it got written up in a lot of papers, and it got a push into the national spotlight, and it has been popular ever since, across the country and in my tummy. I love these episodes because I have a lot to talk about behind the scenes, but also because I got to talk about my favorite sandwich. Listen, we'll eat a Reuben any day of the week. Okay. And now I have listener mail, which is also another one about one of my favorite episodes, which is advent calendars. This is from our listener, Amy, who writes, "Hi, Holly and Tracy. I know you said you wanted to hear about all the advent calendars." That is correct. "This past year, I got my kiddo one from the Exit Game Company. They generally make games that you do all in one sitting, and they take a long time. We both have a hard time getting through that. But the advent calendar had one puzzle a day, and all were tied into a larger storyline. There are multiple options, and she wants to get one every year now. She's 14. So for anyone with a teen, it's a super fun way to bond and make time to be together every day. They're not easy either. You definitely need the teamwork. Here is a photo of it. Also, I don't really have a pet, but here are some gorgeous cardinals I saw in Hawaii. I think they are called red-crested cardinals. Ciao, and thanks for a fabulous podcast." Amy, this is such a cool idea and one I had never heard of. I feel like for people who love puzzle solving, this is a really, really great one. And I do like the idea that you bake in some family time during the holidays when it's busy and it's hard to stop sometimes and take a moment. These cardinals are beautiful. Listen, I'm a crazy bird lady at this stage of my life. I feed the birds and watch them on my deck for hours. So I am very happy for cardinal pictures. And these are very beautiful. They don't look like the ones that we would see in the continental U.S. that are solid red. They are kind of a gray and black with white chests. And then their head is a spectacular shade of red. They're very beautiful. So thank you. I'll take wildlife pictures as much as I'll take a pet. If you would like to share your stories of wildlife, pets, games, advent calendars, sandwiches, I hope we get a lot of things about people's favorite sandwiches. You could do that at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And if you have not yet subscribed to the podcast, that is so easy to do. You can do it on the iHeartRadio app or anywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing.
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ+ bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.